Welcome to Royally Screwed. My name is Chris Shearer, and it's my honor to take you on a tour through some of history's greatest, worst, and bizarre rulers. In this episode, we're going to take a look at, for the sake of simplicity, the final king of France, Louis XVI, and his wife, Marie Antoinette. Now, the French Revolution and the ensuing century's status quo in France, established by Napoleon, did a lot of weird things as far as monarchies and empires are concerned. So, unless I cover Napoleon in a future episode of this show, we're gonna stick with calling Louis XVI the last king of France. At least the last king that ruled from an unbroken line of rulers that could technically be traced all the way back to Roman times. Sounds a bit complicated, right? Yeah, that's why I'm sticking to my guns on this one. Louis XVI and Marie were the king and queen of France during the French Revolution, so obviously there is a lot to unpack with all of that. How did France end up in a state where they decided the revolution needed to happen then? And how did the monarchs deal with that revolution? Spoiler alert, really badly. But Louis's reign was not all about the French Revolution. After all, he ruled for more than a decade before the nation turned against him. What exactly did the king and queen get up to in those years before the monarchy was abolished? They both lived in interesting times, what with it being the Enlightenment period, though that was surely coming to an end soon enough with the previously mentioned revolution. The world was set on fire and turned upside down. Unfortunately, it's hard to stay seated in a throne under those circumstances. So, without further ado, let's begin the story. We're going back in time to the Kingdom of France on the eve of revolution in The Fall of the House of Bourbon. I've talked about the Enlightenment plenty of times on this show, but never as it applied to France. We've mostly been looking at its effects further east, especially in Russia. Well, as Italy was to the Renaissance, France was to the Enlightenment. After a few centuries of that previous era, the Renaissance that is, it became apparent that the old ways, European kings ruling under the divine right of God and getting to do whatever they want, was clearly not the way to go. In France, this was exemplified by none other than Louis XIV, the great-great-great-grandfather of Louis XVI. This Louis, also known as the Sun King, was the French king who built the palace at Versailles. Now, if you don't know anything about Versailles, it is one of the most disgustingly lavish royal palaces to ever exist, which means it's incredibly beautiful to look at. Also, maybe you're wondering about why Louis XIV was known as the Sun King. Early in his reign, Louis chose the sun as his personal symbol. This was done for many reasons. First, it was a symbol often associated with the Greek god Apollo, who is often called the god of the arts. Louis was very into all forms of art. He loved ballet, both watching and performing. He had hundreds of official portraits of him commissioned. And obviously, with the building of a palace like Versailles, he loved architecture. But the second reason to call him the Sun King was probably the most important. The sun is obviously the brightest object in the sky. It's a large celestial body around which every planet in the solar system revolves. By calling himself the Sun King, Louis was looking to paint himself as the focal point of all French culture. He was the sun to which the government and the people revolved around. Well, this decadence went a bit too far for the people of France, including the nobility who had to put up with Louis XIV. The wealthy elite of France would often gather at local coffee shops or within their private salons to complain about the way the king was going about things. After a while, complaints and gossip started turning into intellectual conversation about how things could go if the government was different. While France was very much still a Catholic nation, the philosophers that started writing during this time started thinking about ruling not through the power of God, but through the power of man. Throughout the rest of the Enlightenment, some monarchs would vaguely latch onto this idea. They no longer existed as king or queen, emperor or empress, by the demand of God, but because the people needed a leader who was intelligent enough to get things done. These types of rulers are usually referred to as enlightened despots. Louis XIV was not such a leader. He very much ruled under the terms of an absolute monarchy. Louis also decided to take part in the War of the Spanish Succession, an early 18th century war that was fought to decide the next ruler of the Spanish Empire after the death of Charles II, who died childless. Officially, Charles's heir was Philip of Anjou, one of the grandsons of the Sun King. However, Charles had been a member of the massive Habsburg family, which ruled over several nations for centuries by this point. However, Philip, as well as Louis and his family, were of the Bourbon dynasty. The other Habsburg nations and their allies supported Archduke Charles of Austria and fought against the fear of France gaining all of the land owned by Spain, aka most of the Americas at this point. Well, the war ended with Philip being crowned King of Spain but renouncing any claims to the throne of France. And fun fact, but Philip's descendants are still the monarchs of Spain. The war was costly and bankrupted the Kingdom of France, a bankruptcy which lasted long after Louis XIV's death and continued through the rule of his great-grandson, Louis XV. Louis XV did very little to help alleviate the problem as he waged more wars which further drained the treasury. During all of this, France was also rapidly growing as a nation. The middle class was something that actually existed, albeit only as about 10% of the population in the 1700s. Peasants, who made up a vast majority of the population, were experiencing a decrease in their average pay, while landowners and those who made their wages off of colonies saw their wealth massively increase. On top of all of this, the British colonies in America were starting to act up, and France was always interested in being a thorn in Britain's side. Unfortunately, I don't think the French monarchy knew what it was signing up for when the new king crowned in 1774 decided to side with the American Revolution. Our King Louis, aka Louis XVI, was born in August of 1754 with the name Louis Auguste, which made him more recognizable among the many other Louis in this story. His father's name was, I bet you can already guess, Louis, specifically Louis Ferdinand, the son of King Louis XV. His mother was Maria Josepha, known in French as Marie Joseph, who was the daughter of the Prince Elector of Saxony, meaning a man who was a member of the Electoral College of the Holy Roman Empire, as well as the King of Poland. Louis's maternal grandmother was also a member of the Habsburg dynasty. At the time of his birth, Louis was just considered the second son of the heir assumptive. His older brother, Louis-Joseph Xavier, was the one who would actually be put into the line of succession. Obviously, things are gonna get shaken up a bit if Louis Augustus's grandfather is Louis XV and he's Louis XVI. As a child, our Louis was given a very strong education. Though he was recorded as being very shy, Louis was an excellent student who would learn to speak Latin, Italian, and English besides his native French. He was also a skilled student in history and mathematics, the latter of which would come in handy for his lifelong fascination with cartography, aka studying and drawing up maps. He was also very interested in locksmithing, meaning both making and breaking locks, which was apparently encouraged and thought to be a perfectly suitable branch of research for a child back then for some reason. A lot of modern historians are very critical of the way Louis was taught, though. His teachers, especially those that were supposed to teach him the skills to become a proper king, instead taught Louis that being humble, timid, and inscrutable were all values he should seek to emulate. Not really something you want in your future king. Unfortunately, things wouldn't stay very nice for long for young Louis Auguste. When he was just 6 years old, his older brother passed away from complications involving both an injury to his leg and tuberculosis. Just 4 years later, Louis's father would pass away, also from tuberculosis. This meant that Louis was now the Dauphin, the heir to the throne of France, and he was only 11 years old. But not to let up on the tragedy within his life, Louis's mother would die a year and a half later in March of 1767, yet again from tuberculosis. It's kind of surprising that with that many cases of tuberculosis going on in the royal family that Louis and his two younger brothers also survived to adulthood. Louis's grandfather, the king, passed away in May of 1774 from, take a wild guess, yep, smallpox. Yeah, it was different this time. So now, just a few months shy of 20 years old, Louis Auguste was named the new king of France. And luckily he wouldn't do it alone because he would have his equally famous, if not more so, wife by his side as his queen. Though we mostly know her by her French name, Marie Antoinette, she was actually born Maria Antonia to the Habsburgs of Austria. She was the daughter of two powerhouses in Central Europe. Her father was Emperor Francis I, ruler of the Holy Roman Empire. But more importantly, at least in my opinion, her mother was Maria Theresa, the matriarch of the Habsburg dynasty who ruled over Austria, Bohemia, Hungary, and several other areas throughout her life. If you were a monarch in Europe during the mid to late 18th century, you wanted to be on Maria Theresa's good side. Maria Antonia was born on the 2nd of November 1755. However, the 2nd of November is All Souls' Day, a day of mourning in the Catholic Church, so her birthday was always celebrated the day before. I don't know if this is something everyone did back then, but it's certainly an interesting factoid. Maria spent her childhood in Vienna, where she, like her future husband, received a top-notch education. However, unlike Louis, Maria Antonia was said to be a pretty bad student. I guess it wasn't that she was unintelligent, just not really interested in putting in any effort. It's recorded that by the time she was 10 years old, she could not write in proper German, French, or Italian, all languages she would have grown up learning. She did, however, greatly excel in music. Maria was said to be an excellent singer as well as gifted at the harp, flute, and harpsichord, which is an older version of the piano. When she was only 7 years old, Maria met Mozart, who was about the same age as her and already composing music because Mozart was that good of a musician. By 1768, it was decided that Maria would be engaged to the young Dauphin of France. To facilitate this engagement, a French monk was sent to Vienna to act as Maria's teacher to make sure she was up to the intellectual standards of the French court. She was also given a makeover, which apparently included having a dentist straighten her teeth. Over the next 2 years, Marie was given all sorts of lessons over how to be a perfect member of the royal court in France. The betrothal of Louis and Maria was actually very important for both their nations, though it would prove to be very unpopular in its early days. If you'll remember, France and the Habsburgs had been at odds with each other earlier in the 18th century during the War of the Spanish Succession. Then, during the early childhoods of both royal children, there was the Seven Years' War, which was a very influential war that had battles fought all over the world, technically making it the First World War, predating World War I by about 150 years. A treaty between France and Austria had forced France to enter into the war, in which they got majorly defeated by both the UK and the Germanic nation of Prussia. Ergo, sentiments in France were very much anti-Austrian at this time. This was the brand new world Maria found herself in when she married Louis in May of 1770. And when I say brand new, I mean brand new. She had only moved to France a few days prior and met her husband 2 days before their wedding. Technically, she was already married to Louis when she arrived, with the pair having been married by proxy about a month before the wedding in their respective nations, with different nobles standing in for the other's spouse. The pair were incredibly awkward with each other, which would make sense considering Louis was 15 and Maria, now called by the French name Marie, was 14. Perhaps, fortunately, the couple did not end up consummating the marriage due to this sort of atmosphere. Obviously, 4 years later, Marie would be crowned as Queen of France alongside her husband as king. It's said that even by that point, it's highly likely that the pair had never consummated their marriage. Public opinion on Marie was mostly mixed. Her first public appearance in Paris went well, but French opinions on Austria were still very low, especially among some of the nobles Marie had to interact with regularly. And this strange royal affair would certainly have effects on Louis's reign going forward. If you were alive in France at the time of Louis's coronation and lived to see the end of the French Revolution, it probably would not surprise you that Louis XVI was the last king of France. Things were already off to a bad start just based on the disastrous performance of his predecessor. France was in severe debt and had lost many of its colonies to the British following the Seven Years' War. On top of all this, the populace Louis ruled over were becoming increasingly anti-monarchy with each passing year. And that fact was really disappointing for the new king because, above all else, Louis's greatest desire was to be loved by the people of France. Unfortunately, Louis was really bad about being assertive with his policies. Whenever he issued a decree, he would usually give a preamble about how much good it would do for the people of France, even if the new law wasn't necessarily all that great for them. Meanwhile, Marie was doing very little to improve the public's opinion on her. She was always dressed in the heights of late 18th century fashion, which included many styles that weren't French or employed the use of French fabrics. Given that the kingdom was already in debt, the people decried Marie's lifestyle as further bankrupting France. It got so bad that Marie's own mother had to write to her to suggest maybe it was a good idea for the new queen to spend less money on herself. One of Louis's first major public decrees was the reinstatement of the Parliament, which were a series of 13 courts throughout France that had been disbanded in 1770 after decades of constantly challenging both Louis XIV and Louis XV for laws the Parliament found illegal. Louis XVI knew that reinstating the Parliaments could result in disaster for himself, but he knew it was the general opinion of the people that this was for the good of France. And again, Louis wanted to be loved. In 1787, Louis enacted another major piece of legislation, the Edict of Versailles. This new law provided much more religious freedom in France, something Louis was interested in pursuing, but stopped just short of complete religious tolerance. The Edict of Versailles was enacted to overrule the Edict of Fontainebleau, which was signed into law by Louis XV in 1685. The Edict of Fontainebleau itself was a law that overruled a previous edict that had ensured freedom for the persecution against the Huguenots, a French movement of Protestants. The Edict of Versailles once again allowed Huguenots to practice their religion, and it also granted religious protection for Lutherans and Jews. And throughout all of this, Louis and Marie finally had some children, much to the joy of everyone except for maybe the couple themselves. The royals had three children who survived into adulthood, starting in 1778 with Marie Theresa Charlotte. No longer did Louis have to suffer constant barbs from his fellow nobles, citizens, and brothers-in-law as to whether or not he was actually able to have sex. Unfortunately, having a few kids didn't change the fact that the France of Louis XVI was deeply troubled. When Louis reinstated the Parliament system, he was immediately overwhelmed with orders from lesser nobles complaining about his authority to levy taxes. Within 2 years of his reign, both of the king's finance ministers were forced to retire due to the unpopularity surrounding the state of the French economy. They were replaced by a man named Jacques Necker, a Swiss banker who had radical ideas towards the French economy. Necker was also a big proponent of the ongoing revolution in the newly created United States of America. In 1776, Necker decided that the best way for the French to support the US was not to increase taxes, but to take out massive international loans. The commoners in France were very happy with this new change to the economic system. And in order to increase those positive feelings towards the crown, Necker then published the Compte Rendu au Roi, French for Report to the King, in 1781. This was a financial report that was publicly released to the nation outlining the current state of the economy. According to the report, revenues in the kingdom were wildly exceeding expectations, seemingly meaning that France was operating on a massive surplus. This made everyone even happier. However, what Necker did not report was that the loans the monarchy had taken out to support America against Britain actually heavily offset that surplus, and France was so deep in debt. This would not come to light until Necker was replaced in 1783 after Louis realized that Necker was falsely representing the financial state of the kingdom. When the next finance minister took control, Louis attempted to once again take a stronger stance towards decreasing France's debt. At almost every turn, the parliament system stood in his path. And unfortunately for the king, those courts were much more popular than his reign could ever hope to be. Things got so bad between Louis and the courts that between autumn of 1787 and summer of 1788, Louis shut down several parliament and had several judges arrested. Louis appeared before the Parliament of Paris, the largest and most important court, and used the supreme power of the monarchy to attempt new financial edicts. Unfortunately, due to the extreme debt of France, almost none of these new laws were feasible to practice, at least for any long-term extent. But let's switch gears from economics to talk about Louis's attempts at foreign affairs. Obviously, the biggest name in the game was the American Revolution. France supported America very early on, if only because they knew an American victory would be a massive blow to the UK. In 1778, France signed an official treaty with America against Britain, meaning that, soon enough, France was also now at war with its northern neighbor. This new war, called the Anglo-French War, would actually be a major boon to the US as it forced Britain to divert many resources it could have used in order to defend all of its other territories, meaning Canada, the Caribbean islands, colonies in India, and even Britain itself. Now, here's a fun fact. After a bit into the Anglo-French War, which also saw Spain enter on the side of France, the UK just kinda abandoned the American Revolutionary War. The American mainland colonies were nowhere near as profitable as the Sugar Islands of the Caribbean. By the end of the Anglo-French War in 1783, though, things were actually not looking too hot for France. Yes, America was separated from England, which was technically a massive blow despite what I said previously. However, France hadn't necessarily come out on top. They had only managed to regain colonies in Western Africa and gain control of the island of Tobago. On top of all that, the war had actually driven France further into debt. Also, despite the whole revolution, which was won with the help of several key French military advisors, America was actually buddying up with the UK to create new trade deals. This miserable situation would escalate into a full-blown financial panic in 1786, which was further spurred on by bad harvests. France was quickly spiraling, and soon enough, the people of France came knocking on the doors of Versailles demanding change. But, hey, what was Marie up to during all this? The Queen's public image was constantly in a downward spiral. Some people just genuinely did not like her considering she was Austrian nobility, and French opinions of Austria at this time were always pretty low. It didn't help that whenever Austria ended up in a conflict with another nation, Marie would always ask her husband or the Minister of War to send aid in some way to her homeland. The same also went for the Holy Roman Empire, which was ruled by her brother Joseph from 765 to 790. When her brother got involved in the War of the Bavarian Succession against Prussia, Marie forced Louis to let France be involved with negotiations, which ended up giving Austria more territory. This, among other foreign affairs, would give people of France the idea that Marie would always choose Austria over France. It's also been suggested that Marie was actually the one who got Louis to join in on the American Revolution, though the reasons behind Marie's views were not entirely altruistic. The royal court of France was filled to the brim with factionalism. Marie's desires to join in on the American War was probably due to her wanting to stand against one of her rivals who was against getting involved. Anything Marie did, no matter if it was something that everyone else was doing, was scrutinized and used to slander her. Going against her earlier desires to own the most expensive fashion, Marie's new choice of clothing was a much simpler, though still elegant, form of fashion. Was the clothing still expensive? Yeah, absolutely, she's the Queen of France. However, Marie was accused of attempting to change the overall fashion of France. But, like, trends in fashion change all the time, so I don't think you can really blame her on this one. It was also fashionable for nobles in France at this time to create small villages within their estates. Marie commissioned one such village for Versailles in 1783 that became known as the Hameau de la Reine. The village was criticized as being a waste of money despite the fact that this village was much smaller and simpler than many others of its kind, including one owned by the king's own brother. Also in 1783, one of Marie's male friends, Axel de Fersen, returned to France from America, and rumors began to run amok that the pair were sleeping together. It was historically believed that in fact they weren't, but apparently in 2016, a historical society in France allegedly found a letter between the two confirming some sort of affair. It also didn't help that Marie and Louis's second son, Louis Charles, was born about 9 months after one of de Fersen's visits to the queen. It's now believed that Louis Charles was in fact a legitimate child of Louis XVI, but Axel de Fersen was far from the only person the queen was accused of sleeping around with. Pamphlets were passed around all the time slandering the queen as sleeping with many people around the palace, both men and women. And that leads me to the fun fact of finding out that at this point in history, apparently being a lesbian meant you suffered from the German vice. So I don't know what the German states did at this time to earn that reputation, but go Germany. Marie, in an attempt to gain a further foothold in actual political games, started using her power and influence, especially with her husband, to get her friends and allies placed in position of power. These members of the government were usually fairly conservative and greatly unpopular with the people of France, usually resulting in their removal after several years of service. Whenever they were removed, blame was usually placed solely on Marie Antoinette. She soon became a symbol of the French national debt, with a nickname for her popping up around 1787 being Madame Déficit. On the 8th of August 1788, King Louis announced the return of the Estates General, which we'll get into in just a minute. During this time, constant scandals and issues with the Parliament had put the monarchy at its lowest level of popularity yet. And during this time, Marie and Louis' oldest son, Louis-Joseph, was suffering from tuberculosis. When Louis-Joseph passed away the next June, France was in a state of frenzy. News of the young Dauphin's death barely registered among the public as the king and queen mourned the loss of their son. So, the Estates General, what is it? Well, theoretically, it was an advisory and legislative body that could be called by the king to discuss matters of France. In practice, it was really only the former, an advisory role. It comprised of the three estates. The first estate was the clergy of the Catholic Church. In 1789, this was composed of about 100,000 members. The second estate was the nobility, numbering about 400,000 in 1789. The third estate was made up of the 25 million other citizens of France, from the rich merchants to the lowest peasants. The third estate was also the only group that was forced to pay taxes, though it was easier for the merchants, which most sources I read straight up calling them the bourgeoisie, to find ways around that. Before Louis XVI called for the Estates General to meet in May of 1789, the last meeting of the Estates was in 1614. Given the lengthy amount of time between the meeting of the Estates, no one was entirely sure of how to proceed with things. So instead of updating any rules, which were kinda needed considering the merchants of the Third Estate had grown significantly more powerful in the last century and a half, Louis went with the conservative rules from 1614. This meant that the Third Estate had to wear all black while everyone else got to wear whatever they wanted. When Louis entered the meeting, everyone was supposed to take off their hats for him. The Third Estate refused, so, in a moment of panic, Louis doffed his hat to them. Despite the Third Estate's desire to see radical change to the kingdom in order to prevent a further financial disaster, Louis remained firm and refused to change the way his nation worked. Obviously, this really didn't sit over well. On the 17th of June, the Third Estate decided to take matters into their own hands. They unilaterally declared themselves an entity called the National Assembly. This new body, as decided by the National Assembly, was to hold power equal to that of the king. 2 days later, the First Estate dissolved itself and joined the National Assembly, as did a small handful of the nobility. The very next day, the 20th of June, the National Assembly arrived at the Hall of the Estates General only to find the doors locked and guarded. Outraged, the Assembly met at an indoor tennis court near Versailles. The Assembly then made a vow, now called the Tennis Court Oath, to never separate the estates and to meet up for necessary gatherings until a proper constitution was made. This oath, combined with the fact that Louis had kinda started organizing the army in case he thought action needed to be taken, further galvanized the National Assembly against the monarchy. With a fire in their hearts, on the 14th of July, the National Assembly stormed the Bastille, a major fortress that acted as a military armory and a prison. With this, the French Revolution had truly begun. I want to quickly say here that I always learned of this event as being celebrated as Bastille Day. However, I was once in a Discord server with a guy from France, and when I asked him if he was doing anything to celebrate it, he just responded something like, "What are you talking about? We don't call it that." Which is how I learned that in France it's just the 14th of July. I'm imagining this would kind of be like if Americans found out that for some reason everyone else called it Declaration Day instead of the 4th of July. Over the next couple months, the National Assembly, now calling itself the National Constituent Assembly, began to dismantle the old regime. In August, feudalism was outlawed, drastically reducing the power of nobility. The crown also no longer held any control of the Catholic Church, and tithes, aka a portion of your income set aside for the church, was also made illegal. In October, an angry mob of Parisian citizens stormed the Palace of Versailles and attempted to kill Marie Antoinette. Once the crowd was calmed down and the queen assured her safety, the people of Paris demanded that Louis and his family be moved to Tuileries Palace, which was located within the capital city itself. The people decided that this would force Louis to be more accountable to his people. So, yes, the royal family was forced to abandon Versailles. From late 1789 to mid-1791, Louis and his family were kept in Tuileries. Though several nobles and politicians seemed to secretly move in favor of keeping Louis around, and therefore creating a constitutional monarchy rather than an absolute monarchy, the revolution continued to roll along. The royal family knew that they had to get out of France, but Louis, ever indecisive, kept postponing any actual plans due to his own fears and doubts. And actually, it seemed as if Louis didn't really recognize the actual scope of the French Revolution. Remember, this is a guy who wanted to be loved by the people. While not everyone was actually on board with overthrowing the monarchy, Louis believed that the revolution was just a very vocal minority and soon the silent majority would come to save the day. Unfortunately, this wasn't the case. On the 21st of June 1791, the royal family finally made a move to escape from France into Austrian-controlled lands. Unfortunately, when they reached the town of Varennes in Argonne, a member of the revolution caught the royal family after recognizing Louis's face from the currency of the nation. The royal family was swiftly brought back into Paris and put on house arrest in Tuileries. When news got around that the king and queen had tried to escape, into Austria no less, it further spurred on the members of the revolution. Louis had screwed up big time, and it wouldn't be much longer until it was the last straw. During all of this, France's neighbors watched with bated breath. Austria and the Holy Roman Empire, now under the control of Marie Antoinette's brother Leopold, were really the royals' true lifeline. Prussia was also wary of the revolution. After all, any nation back then currently under a monarchy was worried about what this new era of global revolution meant for their reigns. So, in August of 1791, Holy Roman Emperor Leopold II and Frederick William II of Prussia signed a declaration saying that they would stand by the French royals in the face of the revolution. Obviously, this didn't sit well with the revolutionaries, who quickly decided to go to war with Austria. They invaded the Austrian-controlled Netherlands, only to quickly realize that the locals were not going to get on the revolutionary bandwagon and rise up against the Austrian nobility. In July of 1792, the Duke of Brunswick, a principality of the Holy Roman Empire, signed the Brunswick Manifesto, which was written with the help of Louis XVI's cousin, that decreed his decision to fully restore the King of France to his rightful place and put down any dissenters. Well, in response to this, on the 10th of August, the revolutionaries attacked Tuileries. 3 days later, after being holed up in a chamber within the palace, Louis and Marie Antoinette were taken captive and placed under arrest. A little over a month after Louis and Marie's arrest, the National Assembly called for the dissolution of the monarchy, ushering in the era of the First French Republic. Meanwhile, the royals were imprisoned in a fortress in the Square du Temple, the fortress having been built by the Knights Templar. The revolution's leaders were uncertain of how to deal with Louis XVI. Some called for his execution, while others wanted to keep him around as a bartering chip against France's neighbors. After further shakings within the revolution, like the Republic winning a battle against a German army and more of Louis's private correspondences with the outside world being discovered, it was decided that the king needed to be put on trial. So, in December of 1792, Louis was brought before the National Convention, the new governing body of the Republic. Before the trial even started, Louis apparently told his lawyers that he knew there was absolutely no way he was going to be found innocent against charges of treason. And yes, he most certainly was. However, the new major question was, well, what do we do with the king? This question split the National Convention. Again, some wanted Louis dead, while others just wanted him imprisoned for life. The convention was made up of 721 members. On the 16th of January 1793, 361 members voted for Louis' immediate death. Louis' fate had been decided by a majority of just one vote. The following day, another vote was held to counter that ruling, but it was struck down with a larger majority of 380 votes. Louis would die. So, on the 21st of January, Louis XVI, now simply known as Louis Capet, his surname coming from the Capetian dynasty of which House Bourbon had descended, was brought to a guillotine in the Place de Concorde and beheaded. It's said that before his death, he once more denied any claims of wrongdoing and pardoned those who had accused him. But that still left Marie Antoinette alive and imprisoned. There was not much she could do, and the convention was also split on what to do with the former queen. As with Louis, some wanted her dead. Others thought she could be sold back to Austria in return for French prisoners of war that were being held captive. Thomas Paine, one of the founding fathers of America, suggested exiling her to the United States. Marie was without any allies. Her mother had been dead for over a decade. Her brother Leopold had tried and failed, then died in 1792. Leopold's successor, his son Francis, was ambivalent to his aunt and refused to send her aid. In July of 1793, Marie's remaining son, 8-year-old Louis Charles, was forcibly separated from her, and he was forced to undergo a retraining process to make him hate his parents. On the 14th of October 1793, Marie would also receive a trial for her alleged crimes against the nation. The accusations thrown her way were the same things she had been hearing ever since she arrived in France. She practiced sexually indecent acts. She had forced the state to pay millions of livres, the French currency at the time, to afford her lavish lifestyle. She was also accused of attempting to have Louis Charles named as the new king of France after her husband's death. And the most upsetting were accusations of sexually abusing her son, which Louis Charles's handlers forced him to say was the truth. 3 days later, after being declared guilty on all charges, Marie Antoinette was condemned to death by beheading. She was to be killed in the same day she learned of the outcome of the trial. Like her husband, Marie was thrown into an unmarked grave. With the former monarchs dead and buried, the revolution came to rage on as thousands more met their deaths in the name of liberty and freedom. The French Revolution would last for 6 more years after the deaths of Louis XVI and Marie Antoinette. In 1799, Napoleon Bonaparte would seize control of the nation and control the government for 5 years before declaring that he was the emperor of the new French Empire. For only a little over a decade was France free of a monarchy. However, Napoleon's empire would not last. In January of 1855, Louis XVI's younger brother, Louis Stanislaus Xavier, regained control of France and reigned as Louis XVIII. He was called Louis XVIII because Louis and Marie's son was technically considered king by royalists until his death in 1795. Louis XVIII had the former king and queen's bodies recovered and given proper burials. However, even Louis's brothers, because then his other brother Charles would also reign, would see their kingdom collapse. France would go through phases of kingdoms, empires, and republics until 1870, when any sort of monarchy in France was fully defeated, paving the way for a new republic, which would then also collapse. Look, modern-day France is technically the 5th French Republic. It's all very messy. But I guess the major question at the end of this episode is, were Louis and Marie bad rulers? Were they actually the reason why the French Revolution happened? In some ways, yes, but at least in my opinion, it's mostly no. I think the revolution still would have occurred no matter who sat on the throne of France. The monarchy had been the epitome of the wealthy elite. The earliest signs of a revolution in France existed long before Louis was even born. And sure, Marie's lifestyle definitely forced an ailing French economy to grow worse, but it wasn't her alone that bankrupted the nation. If Louis's older brother hadn't died young, I'm sure he would have continued the family tradition, and the revolution might have occurred at some point during his reign too. Louis XVI was indeed a weak king, but he wasn't any sort of overlord tyrant that would have forced the French citizens' hands into a revolution. He just happened to be the man on the throne when the guillotine started dropping. Also, as a final note, Marie Antoinette never said, "Let them eat cake." First, and less important, the original line is actually, "Let them eat brioche." Second, and more importantly, this line is believed to have been made up by the Swiss philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who, in one of his writings, claimed to have heard it was a phrase uttered by a, as he says, great princess. So he never even called out Marie Antoinette to begin with. But for now, that's it for this week's episode of Royally Screwed. I hope you enjoyed the journey. Be sure to subscribe to the show and tell a friend all about it. Next time, we are back in the Julio-Claudian saga for one final ride as we finally cover the death of Emperor Nero. How does a dynasty like that meet its end? And what does it mean for the future of Rome? I hope you'll join me then for another topsy-turvy look into history's most interesting rulers.